Sunday afternoon. We're getting a taste of elements of Vedic culture. Of course, Vedic culture is an ancient culture of antiquity, and we do not exactly know everything about Vedic culture today. But still, there are many Vedic scriptures left. Although the vast majority of Vedic scriptures is these days not available. In fact, they say that approximately 6% of the Vedic literature is still available today. As it is recorded, we have records of a certain amount of scripture, and only 6% of these scriptures are now still available. So it's a small percentage, 6%, if you think about it. So maybe many aspects of Vedic culture are not known to us today. But whatever is known to us today is still valuable, and that is maybe the theme of our program, that we put elements of this culture on display or available to all in various ways: values, ideas, concepts, music, meditation, literature, the Vedic kitchen, which is still very much alive. So in this way, many of these elements are here in the festival, and I am, with this talk, I guess, adding some perspective to it all. At least it feels like that's probably what I should do. So let me begin, as is done in the Vedic tradition, with some mantra. So far we chanted the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra on music as a form of meditation, but now I'll chant some invocation mantras before I really begin to speak. Om Ajnanatinandasya Gyanandana Salakaya Chakshurunmilitam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namah. Shri Chaitanya Manovistam Sthapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Tadate Svapadantikam. Vandeham Sigaro Sigurta Padakamalam Sigurum Vaisnavam Scha Sirupam Sagrajatam Sagnaravaratam Vitam Tam Sajivam Sarvetam Savadutam Parijana Saitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sagana Lalita Sivisakam Vitam Scha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadha Sivasadi Gaura Bhaktavinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The Vedas are, of course, the scriptures of India. But Veda is not one book. If we speak of the Vedas, we're speaking about a library. Who can deal with a library? Not everyone. Some people. But maybe not in so much in our modern way of life, where we have a little bit of time. We can have a library on an e-book reader, but do we have time to read it? Life is hectic. Therefore, the culture of the day is Facebook. It's quick, it's short, it doesn't allow long posts. It allows only short posts, quick, bang, it's there, and if you can't express it in 5 or 6 lines, you know, don't bother me telling me about it, you know. Interviewers sometimes ask us, can you tell in one line what your philosophy is all about? Well, we can tell you in one line, of course, but what do you expect in one line? That you go very deep? Or that you really capture everything? Yes. In one line? Yes, we can. We can tell you. In one line, we can say that every living being is not this body, but rather is an eternal spirit soul that is temporarily residing in the body. And that the eternal spirit soul can only be satisfied and fulfilled in service to the Supreme Lord. And as long as the living being is serving any other means or any other goals, there will not be satisfaction. Yeah. Okay, that would be in one line. Now if I can use a few more sentences, then I could say, yes, this world has not come about by chance. The evolution theory that was presented to us makes less and less sense these days than it ever did. Because Darwin had a basic premise, and the basic idea of Charles Darwin was that life evolved from very simple species to complex species. So his concept was that from the one-celled living being came complex living beings with a multiple cell structure like ourselves. And then his concept of the cell in those days was a cell consists of a nucleus and basically protoplasm around it, some sort of jelly-like substance. Nowadays, we have a different idea about cells. Now when we look at a cell, we see an intricate model which is very refined in terms of distribution of energies, and it's like, it looks more in complexity, like a city. The channels and all the various processes that are going on within the cell are highly complex. So that was not known at that time. So it's the theory, the premise, the basic premise is not right. That is the first thing. And the second question is, how could so much complexity come about by chance? Mathematically, it doesn't seem to rhyme. Therefore, more and more, the idea gains ground also in the modern world that possibly there is an intelligent design behind the world. Yes, we are back with the Vedic culture. Intelligent design is a fact. There is a divine plan behind the material world, according to the Vedic literature. Not only is there a divine plan behind the world, there is also a divine purpose behind the world. It's not only this is all the energy of the Supreme Lord, it is also the purpose of this world is the purpose of the Supreme Lord. So it's not that we are here to find our own purpose. So what to do with my life? Oh, the big question, what do you do with your life? You know, what shall I do? It's not complicated for one who understands that it's not about my purpose, but it's about the purpose of the Supreme Lord. So, obviously, the Supreme Lord is all good, all kind, all merciful, and the well-wisher of all living beings. In Sanskrit, Suridam Sarva Dehinam, the friend and well-wisher of all living beings. So, therefore, when we say that the world is going on by some intelligent design, then we understand that it's a benevolent plan, that behind that plan, the idea is to benedict all living beings. That is the desire of the Supreme Lord. no other desire. So benedicting all living beings is meant that, yeah, what kind of benedictions could one receive? Well, we can receive many benedictions in this life. Give me health, give me wealth, give me beauty, give me money, give me honey, give me juice in life, right? Like this, we can pray, oh Lord, won't you buy me one Mercedes-Benz? But that kind of blues, right, is temporary. Some temporary gain. So it is said, in spiritual life, to pursue temporary gains is not at all, it's not at all worthwhile. What's the point? Now we are gaining something, we're building a big sand castle, and tomorrow it's blown away by the wind. Then, so what's effort? So therefore it is said, the true purpose of life is to invest in the eternal. To somehow or other, in life, take a few moments, if we can, to invest in the eternal. Oh yes, we have to also invest in the temporary, naturally. We have to sleep, we have to wake up, we have to take bath, we have to eat, we have to make money, we have to do so many things. But that's not all there is. There is obviously more. The eternal aspect of life. That's the real aspect of life. The soul is eternal. After this body ends, the soul is still there. And then the destination of that soul will be determined of what kind of eternal activities we have done. As simple as that. So, that is our aim. That is our aim. To somehow or other invest in the eternal. And to keep the internal always in our mind. And to... because that investment will stay. All the other things will not stay. When I was quite young, I went to India and I had a shocking experience in India. And that was that one day I came out of my hotel and there was a dead body lying on the street. So where I'm from, there are no dead bodies lying on the street. I'm from the Netherlands. We don't have that in the Netherlands. You know, somehow or other, I had never seen such a thing, you know. They don't leave them lying around for some reason. I don't know. But in India, they don't care. Oy vey. That's all right. Chalega. Yes. No problem. So, there is this dead body lying in the street, and nobody seemed to care about it. You know, everyone walked past as if it was the most normal thing in the world. And the only one who was shocked was me. So I stood there looking like, oh my God, what is that? And then people were walking past and they were throwing coins on the body. I looked again and I saw that the man was poor, that he was a beggar. I had seen him sitting at the side of the road the day before. He was gone. Meanwhile, people were throwing money on the body, and within about 10-15 minutes, the whole body covered in coins. I thought, this is amazing. This man was a beggar, he never had a cent in his life. Now he's dead, and now they bury him in money. It's kind of ironic. You know, if they would have given it to him yesterday, maybe he was still alive. Yeah. A typical Western mind. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, my curiosity got the better of me, and I had to ask someone, what's happening here? What are you all doing? Then they said, you know, When someone dies, then at that point, the person goes out of the body and he can no longer go back. At that point, he's floating above the body and he can hear, he or she can hear everything, everything that is going on, but no one can hear that person. I am here. Nobody hears. One cannot go back. It said that at that stage, someone who has moved on has to give up the old body and move on to a next destination. Yeah. But of course it's difficult because suddenly one finds oneself outside the body and one is attached. One is trying to get back in. Somehow or other, and it doesn't work. Then what to do? Then they say in the Vedic culture, therefore, the body must be burned as soon as possible. So that, therefore, when a person would die during the day, they would burn the body the same day. Or if a person would pass on during the night, where they would burn it before the sunrise. So that that living being who had now left the body would be forced to move on to the next destination and then carry on its destiny. And it said, because this man had no money for the firewood, everyone chips in. So I was shocked. I was right there in the middle of a culture which gave more importance to the soul than to the body. I mean, something that blew my mind. Right? I'm from the kind of country where, you know, they sent a helicopter that an operation that can cost like hundreds and thousands to save one person, man. Things like this. Yeah, that's where I'm from. And here, that was not the case. People were not interested in saving his body, but they were interested in saving his soul. And where I'm from, nobody worries about those things. So it was an interesting contrast, and to use a colloquial term, it blew my mind. Right? And I never forgot it. Right? I never forgot that. Later, I read the Bhagavad Gita, and I read the same philosophy in the Bhagavad Gita. I actually saw the Bhagavad Gita puts the emphasis on the soul and not on the body. And then I could understand, yes, obvious, this is a fact. And with that illustration, with that experience that I had, the Bhagavad Gita really came to life for me. And so in this way, I began to appreciate eternity. Now the nice thing is that the Supreme Lord is present everywhere, not only in the heavens or somewhere in the spiritual world, right? Above, here on the ceiling, we have a blue sky and some clouds. Wow, you're a real artist. Anyway, so we have a blue ceiling and we have clouds, and that somewhere above the clouds, there is the Supreme. No, he's everywhere. He's here. He is present with us right now. He's all-pervading. He's present everywhere. But in this world, only visible to those who are his surrendered devotees. Just last night, we had a discussion about saints, about saints in different traditions in the world, and how in the Catholic Church they burn a candle, and how in Islam they have prayers, right? And how in India they have santas, and you know, everywhere, every tradition has its saints. And these saintly personalities are outstanding, and they have some inner strength, some inner conviction, some inner knowing of some higher knowledge than other people. They seem to perceive the Supreme Lord. And they are very, very strong in their faith, and they have an inner happiness which is not shaken by external circumstances. That is a fact. For those who are becoming dedicated servants, they get another level of perception. That's exactly what goes on. I remember an interview with Carl Jung, which I particularly liked, and it's on film. And the interviewer asked Mr. Jung, "Do you believe in God?" And Jung says, "No, I don't believe in God." So the interviewer is shocked, because Jung was known as a very religious person. So for 10 long seconds, there was an eerie silence. The interviewer had sort of probably prepared the whole interview, and then suddenly Jung had just torpedoed his whole interview. "No, I don't believe in God." And then he says, after the pause, "I know that God exists." Wow, that's deep. At least I used to think. But it is deep, it is a fact. It means that he had been a long-term practitioner, a long-term devotee. It means that he had dedicated his life for a long time according to the will of the Supreme Lord. If one adjusts his life according to the will of the Supreme Lord, then he becomes manifest. It begins with a book. It begins with a priest. It begins with someone telling us what to do. It begins with the book telling us how to live, how not to live. And yeah, okay. How do you know it's true? Yeah. How do you know? I mean, do you have to be a believer? well, you know, that's nice, but, you know, I mean, why would I? Why would I be a believer? I'm not convinced about that. Just blindly? So no need to be a believer, but try it out. Try out the experiment. One who is actually dedicating his life to following the words of scriptures gets realization. And realization means gets another level of perception and an experience. And that's where it becomes interesting. The stage before the experience is where spiritual life is duty, where spiritual life has an element of heaviness and an element of many rules, that many prohibitions, where we feel encaged and where sometimes we feel like breaking free. And therefore we see many people who feel, "I want to get out of this suffocating religion of my ancestors that has been imposed upon me since I was a child." Yeah? Hell, you know, anyway, you know what I mean? I'm tired of hell, you know? I'm tired of hell. I don't want to hear about hell. I don't believe in hell, one might say. Quite common these days, because we live in a modern world and all this medieval type of thinking, a devil with horns and so on, yeah, is not so popular these days, not so much in the foreground. I'm also not going to enter into that discussion. I am saying that, no, I'm looking at the positive spiritual experience. And the positive spiritual experience goes beyond religions. The world is divided up in religions, right? You can buy maps that show the world in different colors, in different countries, different religions predominating the scene. And, here in Cape Town, we have a bit of a mix, a bit of everything, because of so many visitors that came to the Cape and settled here. Fine. We have so many different religions. Why? We have so many different religions because ultimately in this world, if there is a God, we can't see him. He's invisible to us. That is the issue. But we see that the saintly persons can break through an experience. So that is what the Vedic texts are offering. And they offer a process by which one can elevate himself. Meanwhile, they offer detailed descriptions, very detailed descriptions, of this world and of the next, of the purpose of it, of what we are going through now, where it is all leading to, and in that way, it's very clear, very, very clear. So when life is very clear, when the vision in life is very clear, then we know what to do. Then that big question, what shall I do with my life, is clear. One in some traditions, the emphasis is on avoiding the sin, on avoiding sin and avoiding punishment and avoiding suffering. And there is a lot of emphasis in the teachings about that, that those who will not follow will suffer. The inspiring aspect of, or one inspiring aspect of the Vedic culture, is that it's positive. There is an emphasis, there is explanation of sinful activities, and that every action is a reaction, and that you have to pay for it. But it's not where the focus is. The focus is on the positive activity of glorifying the most wonderful, the most amazing thing in the world. Why wouldn't we do that? Like, let's say, Cape Town is glorified for Table Mountain. It is impressive, that mountain sort of in the middle of the city. It has something, that city around the mountain. So when we speak about Cape Town, Table Mountain, Paris, Eiffel Tower, New York, Statue of Liberty. It's a letdown. It's much smaller than on the picture. I tell you that. Yeah. God, you know, you think it's enormous. It's just, it's nothing big. What to say? So there is a tendency to glorify something. That is natural. It's a natural tendency. When something is glorious, that we give it the attention. So why not give the attention and all the glory to the most glorious thing of all, the Supreme Lord? That's the logic. Therefore, it is said, the Vedic culture is offering us the process of kirtan. And kirtan is the process of constant glorification of the name, fame, qualities, pastimes, and so on, of the Supreme. So that is what we do. Therefore, you can see everything is colorful. You can see it's festive. You can see our little temple is very festive. And it's not only today that it's a feast, a celebration. It always is. It always is. Every day is a celebration. Every day is a feast. Because every day we're celebrating the most wonderful glories of the Supreme Lord. We're remembering them. We speak about them. We worship him. But in great happiness. So there it is. So if there is something about the Vedic way, it is susukam kartam avyam. It is joyfully performed. It is very joyfully performed. It's a blissful process. And that makes it very attractive. It's not a process of great austerity, endless fasts. Are you seeing the light? Not yet. But, you know, that's not our process. Although austerity is certainly valuable. One can through austerity overcome some material entanglement. But it's not required. It's not required. Only the natural austerity that exists in this world. In this world, it's an austerity to get out of bed. And then from there, it carries on, what shall we say? So that element of austerity is there. But otherwise, it is blissful. It is very blissful. So that is the underlying mood of the festival. A blissful glorification of the Supreme Lord. The little colorful flags, the garlands, the everything is aimed at that. More I will not capture in one talk. So I'll leave a little time now for your questions. And then the program will continue. After that, there will be a little more chanting and this time dancing. And after that, it it's interesting. The first question is, I want to know why the Vedic knowledge makes you so happy. That's interesting. Well, yes, because it's positive. It's positive. You see, we're looking at the positive. Yes, we avoid the negative. We mark our bodies with these clay marks. You've seen them, right? And you may wonder why. It's often asked, you know, when we are on TV, and someone asks, "What is that?" Some people are less polite and say bird droppings. But leaving all that, what does it mean? This is sacred clay, known as tilak. And the sacred clay is marking that the body is a temple. So when our body is a temple, well, you don't throw a barrel of beer inside the temple, do you? Right? So automatically, when we are recognizing our body as a temple, all right, then we have to treat it like a temple. And suddenly, we have to deal in a saintly way. So this little sign on the forehead has deep meaning and deep consequences. So Vedic culture gives us but it gives us the positive. We say, yes, my life is dedicated to worship. My life is dedicated to glorification. And we explore the amazing qualities of the Supreme. And those qualities are very blissful. And for that, we live a life that is pure. Then you are free from guilt. You see, guilt is such a thing. When you know that really, you shouldn't have done it, but you did it anyway. What can you do? Right? Or when you close the curtains so that nobody knows, but still, it's going on. Then what remains in the heart is guilt. Guilt. Yeah. So Krishna consciousness, and guilt wears us down. So Krishna consciousness starts off with purity. We are free from guilt. And then we fill our time with exploring the and glorifying the positive qualities of the Supreme. That gives great bliss and satisfaction. And then we try then to other living beings, we try to be kind and merciful. And that also gives great satisfaction to your heart. These are all sources of happiness. That's tough. Yeah. I would like to know where we should draw the scribbles between caring for something of other people and carry. Is someone good at reading? Okay. Huh? Oh yeah, but sometimes the person that asks the question feels embarrassed when the spotlight on the person. So unless they volunteer, you want to ask them. But you know, God, you should become a doctor. I recommend you become a doctor.
I'd like to know where we should draw the line between caring for the bodies of other people and caring for their souls. Basically, I'd like to know, you said, like the beggar, nobody cared for his body, but everybody cared for his soul. But now, if you explain it to people with less understanding, it might give them the idea that we shouldn't care about the body. Okay. So where do we draw the line?
Yes.
Where is that balance?
Okay. Sorry about that. I couldn't read.
I'm getting old, I think. Gosh. It's just small scribbles. Somebody can do that. Anyway, so naturally, when I told the story, I spoke about the Vedic culture, and I spoke about the importance of investing in the eternal aspect, which means the soul, but not to the exclusion of the temporary. Of course, normal physical requirements are to be taken care of. We need to eat, we need shelter, we need to dress, and so on. We need medical care. So we need to be kind to people. We need to help the poor, and all these kind of activities are meant to go on. However, these things are of a secondary nature. Not that they are not important. Obviously, in the winter, we need to have warm clothes, but it's not enough, even if we have all material comforts. So the Vedic model is that material needs are to be taken care of, but then one should not just expand and expand and expand those needs. One should also learn to be satisfied when the needs are met in a reasonable way, and not like one more and more and more, and rather spend time and energy on the eternal side. So the emphasis remains on the spiritual side, but the material side must be taken care of. And obviously, there's a lot to take care of, and especially in family life, small children are completely dependent and have so many needs, and the needs have to be there. Right? We may tolerate a little hardship, but kids are more vulnerable, and even we are vulnerable. So we have our needs, and those needs may be met, and we're not fanatic about it. You know, it's not that you have to have the most austere, the most simple, minimum level of survival, and beyond that, only the spiritual. No, there can be comfort, but do know that whenever you work with the material energy, that nothing comes by itself. Everything has strings attached to it that are attached to other things, and that lead to so many complications. Yeah. Like I sang the song, "Won't You Buy Me a Mercedes-Benz?" And of course a Mercedes-Benz is nice when you drive, but not so nice when you drive it into the garage, right? Because, you know, the bills are extreme. So in this way, everything comes with so many complications. So in Vedic culture is recommending that we keep things a little simple so that we are free, that we have time free, energy free for spiritual life. And therefore by Vedic standards, the modern society, the modern way of life is overkill. Yeah? It's definitely, we're taking it too far and trying to create more and more facilities for our enjoyment and variety, and it's just, and then you have it all, and then you have to pay for it all. It's like, for example, in the Netherlands, in the city of Amsterdam, we have a temple which is in just an ordinary street, and then at one point they gave us a bill for the cable television. And we had to pay for it. And we said, we don't have television. Right? We don't have any television. They said, no, but you have the right to have television. Thanks a lot. And we have to pay for that. Right? We have to pay for that right. You know? So living in this world, which has so many artificial things, and like, you know, and we don't even have it. We really don't have television, right? But still we have to pay. Right? So that's the complexity of the modern world. Too complex. So sometimes one may question, is that really, is this the right direction the world is going? Now China and India are becoming modernized, and you can imagine what that will do to the planet. From an ecological point of view and so on, how can it go on? The average American consumes 10 times more of anything than any other nationality. An American uses 10 times more water than most other nations. I don't know what they do with all water. And it's 10 times more butter. It's like, it's a ratio of 1 to 10. I'm giving gross statistics. And yeah, America predominates the world culture. So what are we doing? Becoming consumers. I have a few more questions. I'll try and go through a little faster. If a devotee dies, can he or her wear clothes? Because people say that you don't have to wear clothes. No, in the Vedic culture, one wears clothes. Yeah. Well, we are born without clothes into this world. So when we leave the world, then we also leave the things of this world, so we leave the clothes. So there's some logic behind it. Right? But for the sake of not being distracted, you know, at the time of the final ceremony, where we are trying to remember that person, where we're trying to get some last good wishes, some last benedictions for that person, In order to not be distracted, it is good if the dress is there. And then we can focus on our real business instead of being distracted by the body. What is the meaning of the mantra? Scribble, scribble. Is it more special than other mantras? If so, why? The Vedic literature has many mantras. The word man means mind. The word tra means what sets free. So what sets free the mind. So mantra, different mantras have an influence on the mind that is full of entanglement and can free the mind of this kind of entanglement. But this mantra, the Hare Krishna mantra, is known as the Maha Mantra, the great mantra. And why is it so? Because it invokes the name of the Supreme Lord directly. And therefore it says through this mantra, the Supreme Lord is directly present, and it's not only setting our mind free from the negative, but it's also giving us the ultimate positive spiritual experience, and therefore it is the best mantra. Why wear orange robes? Yeah, that question also came to my mind. When I saw these Hare Krishnas walking in my town, that's exactly what I thought. Why wear orange robes? And I thought, forget it. I would never do such a thing. That's what I thought. That's the second thought. Yeah. And I began to read more about this culture, then I began to understand that this color is meant to be saffron. And saffron is the color that is connected to the Supreme Lord. This color saffron is a color of for one who is dedicating all his energy for a spiritual purpose and nothing else. So that's not simple. Not simple, therefore we see it's not so common. But it is very nice. Very nice. Once I was in Bengal on a train and I was wearing these clothes, and there was one young man who was wearing Bermuda shorts with a flower design on it. And he comes to me and he goes like, look at those clothes. And I just went to him like, look at those clothes. And then he says, and then I said to him, I said, look, are you wearing that every day? He said, no, of course not, you know, not every day, you know. I said, oh, but I'm wearing these clothes every day. You know why? You know, because they're spiritual. And because they're spiritual, they give me a connection with a higher goal. And therefore, I'm satisfied to wear them every day. I don't need to one day wear shorts with flower designs, and the next day a shirt with stripes. No, I can wear it every day, and I'm very satisfied, because it connects me. Now that's it. Do we need to believe in God? No, but we can also, but we should also not disbelieve. When I meet an atheist, then I congratulate him. Then I say, sir, I'm so impressed. I'm so impressed. It's so rare to find someone who has so much faith. Really? Yeah. You have full faith that there is no God. How do you know? Congratulations, you are a real believer. Everyone else is sort of in doubt, you know, maybe yes, maybe no, but this man,
No, there is no God.
A lot of faith.
Impressed.
Right. So, we're not asking for that kind of faith. Faith in advance.
Okay. Put your faith on the table. Yeah? First faith, and then, you know, you can have God.
No, always say, don't rule him out. Leave the possibility open. Huh? Say, yes, well, there might be a God. There may well be. In that case, experiment and live a life according to the scriptures. And then see what happens. And as I said before, then that alteration of consciousness will come and we'll get a different perception. Then we will not just, then we don't have to believe in God. Then we know that God exists. Again, do you embrace other belief systems? And then, / religious, there's a little thing in the question mark which I don't get. But get the gist of it. Yes, we do accept other belief systems, maybe not completely, that's obvious. Okay? It is obvious that we are accepting this particular belief system because we think it's the best, otherwise I wouldn't be here. But we also see the common knowledge in all belief systems and in all cultures of the world, and therefore we can appreciate. So we don't need to condemn left and right, although we may feel that in other belief systems some incompleteness is there in comparison to what the Vedas offer. We think it's more complete, but we can respect other belief systems. And that's the nice way. So then we don't have to be sectarian and that kind of thing. No, we can embrace every man of God. We can embrace. You said that if one follows the will of God, he will become manifest. How does one know what the will of God is? One knows it through scriptures and through his devotees. Through saintly persons. Obviously we see that in the world saintly persons show wonderful qualities. They are selfless. They are working for the benefit of others. Like they have something extraordinary. Think of Mother Teresa, or here in South Africa, think of Nelson Mandela. Okay? Not an ordinary man, by no means, to come after 27 years out of jail and without hate in his heart. And it's not false. We've seen consistent. That's not a small thing. It's like many of us would have, you know, a little bit of like, you know, okay. Now, first I'll play sweet, and then once I'm in power, then I'll get you back. But we didn't see that in Mandela at all. So there is greatness there. There is greatness. There is selflessness. So we can recognize such qualities in people. Therefore we can recognize great personalities. So when we see great saintly persons in religions, we can recognize them by their qualities. So it's through saintly persons and through scriptures that we can know what is the will of God. I thank you very much for spending the afternoon with us. I hope you found it interesting. We hope you will return and find out more about Vedic culture. Some of you may feel that Vedic culture is for you, and others may feel that another belief system is for you. But those who stay rooted in another tradition may, at least hopefully today and in future meetings, develop some appreciation for this tradition and that it has a valuable contribution to make to the world. And that is, then we would consider our festival a success. Thank you very much.